Welcome to another episode of Real Science Radio. I'm Fred Williams, software engineer and creation speaker. Bob is on assignment, literally. He's heavily involved in a debate at theologyonline.com on the question of, is the King James Bible the only inspired scripture on earth today? So more on that in a moment. I also want to quickly talk about a recent study that showed atheists use less of their brain function. So that should be fun. And finally, we have a special guest who will be with us shortly. So back to the King James only debate. Bob has teamed with former Real Science producer Will Duffy to debate against a widely recognized KJV only proponent, Will Kinney. So Bob and Will recently traveled to England. We talked about this in the show last week, and they specifically went to Oxford University to prepare for this debate. And you really need to check out the debate because the material they uncovered, which really can only be done in person, is really impressive. The debate, again, is featured as a headline at theologyonline.com, so you can't miss it. They just wrapped up, I think they're in round four of a five-round debate, so definitely go over there and check it out. It's great stuff. Now, regarding the King James only, I kind of wanted to share my own story on this. So some of you may know, I was a pretty carnal Christian for much of my early life, up to age about 35, and then it was Bob's TV show, among other things, that turned me around. It started kind of making me real interested in the Bible. I mean, I started just really digging into stuff, both creation and the Bible. Well, it was during this time I came across a King James only website, and they made some impressive arguments. And, you know, I fell hook, line, and sinker. And I guess in a symbolic sense, I did a book burning at my house because I got rid of all the Bibles that weren't King James only. So it was probably, I don't know, maybe over a month or so, I started kind of wondering, well, you know, is this really the case? I started hearing some counter arguments. The final nail in the coffin for me was I went to this fair in Denver, the People's Fair. Now I'm looking at my producer through the glass, Jamie, who was at that fair. He was in a booth called God is Nowhere. So I'm thinking, hey, this is an atheist booth, and I'm going to go in there and see what they're saying just to challenge them. And it turns out they're actually apologetics for, you know, creation and the Bible. And also, just so you know, God is nowhere, you could also pronounce that as God is now here. So that was a neat trick on words that they would do to kind of lure atheists into that booth. Well, anyways, at this time, Jamie was debating a King James only proponent. And I'm telling you, he just thrashed that guy. And at this time, I don't know Jamie. I have no idea who he is. And so here we are years later. I would say, I don't know, that was maybe 15 years ago. So Jamie had some impressive arguments, and it wasn't too long after that I was off the King James only kick. And I guess the message for everybody out there is, before you go, you know, cook up a bonfire in your backyard to burn books, you know, look, consider both sides of the argument. And I hadn't done that at the time. And once I heard both sides, it became clear to me that the King James only belief is just not valid. And hey, if you have any doubts about it, go to theologyonline.com, because I'm telling you, it's a fantastic debate. So before we get to our special guest, I wanted to quickly comment on a recent story in the news that I was asked about. It's a new study performed at the University of York and published in the journal Social, Cognitive, and Affective Neuroscience. And it used targeted magnetism to shut down part of the brain responsible for logic and reasoning. The result? Atheists use less brain function in the section of logic and reasoning. You know, what resulted from the study was a 30% increase in disbelief in God. And here's something kind of strange from the study. It also increased positive feelings towards immigrants who criticize America. You know, I don't know what that means. I don't know if they asked the question, maybe, you know, how do you feel about immigrants who don't like our country? Then they zapped them with the magnetic waves and their response was, I like them. So anyways, seriously, here's was my take when I first saw this story. We know from Romans 1 that God's invisible attributes are clearly seen, so that those who deny him, atheists who deny him, are without excuse. And that would include without being able to say, well, hey, I had a part of my brain that, you know, controls logic and reasoning. You know, that was part of why I didn't believe in you. Well, as we are at Real Science Radio, we tend to be a little cautious on these stories. That's my take on it. On the other hand, though, the study does support this intertwined connection between logic and reasoning and God who gave us this ability. From Hebrews 11:1, it says, faith is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. So again, I don't want to put too much into this type of study. It was only 38 individuals, but it is kind of humorous. And of course, the evolutionists who did this study, they have to put their evolutionary spin on it. One of the authors, Dr. Keyes Azuma, said, As expected, we found that when we experimentally turned down the posterior medial frontal cortex, people were less inclined to reach for comforting religious ideas, despite having been reminded of death. So this doesn't seem to really fit their worldview. They would have less reasoning as they stop believing in God. But they spin this by saying that that part of the brain evolved to deal with threats and was also repurposed to produce religious feelings. So, wow. You know, Romans 8:7 says the carnal mind is enmity against God. And here's yet another example. We could do a whole show on these studies that these atheists do through the years, trying to prove that they're smarter than we are. I mean, I remember a study a few years ago that showed that the activist atheist, those who are actively promoting their belief, are more likely to be angry and narcissistic. And the same study showed that they scored lowest when it comes to agreeableness and positive relationships with others, except maybe for illegal immigrants. But I digress. So anyways, tonight at 7 p.m. is the monthly Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship meeting. It's held at Calvary Apostolic Church, just a few blocks east of I-25 on Yale. There's going to be a great speaker there tonight, so you really want to get out there if you can. The speaker is Dr. Marcus Ross of Liberty University. This guy has some very impressive credentials. He's got a Bachelor of Science in Earth Science from Penn State University, a Master of Science in Paleontology from South Dakota School of Mines and Technology, and a PhD in Geosciences from the University of Rhode Island. He is the lead author of a recently released textbook, The Heavens and the Earth, Excursions in Earth and Space Science. I would now like to welcome to Real Science Radio, Dr. Marcus Ross.
Hey, thank you very much, Fred. Appreciate the chance to be on the show with you today.
Oh, man, we're so excited to have you here. Now, I know Bob's bummed that he can't be here. He gives his regrets. As mentioned earlier, he's actively involved in a debate right now. And, man, I know geosciences is, I'm pretty sure it's Bob's favorite topic. So I know he's bummed he can't be here. So I'm kind of curious, what actually got you into the whole creation evolution battle?
Well, you know, Fred, I caught the dinosaur bug when I was just a little kid. I remember very vividly visiting with my cousins, and my older cousin had one of those read-along records. Younger listeners, that's the plastic discs that don't spin so fast. It was a dinosaur one, and, you know, there was all this roaring and crashing and screeching and music and, you know, this person talking about these dinosaurs, and he didn't have the book to go along with it, but I was just captivated by the recording of this. And from that point onward, since I was four, you know, it was everything I could do to find each book at the library, read it over 20 times, you know, really kind of dedicate myself, even as a little kid, to this. I wanted to be a baseball player or a, you know, fireman or an Air Force pilot. But when it really came down to it, my first love was always dinosaurs, and that's always where I wanted to be. And the others were backups.
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, kids love dinosaurs. And as you probably well aware of, it's also the evolutionist's favorite evangelical tool to start reaching kids early. I remember a Dr. Seuss book that talked about dinosaurs being millions and millions of years old.
It is, you know, and they've got a perspective on the way that the world history is supposed to have been. And dinosaurs are, you know, fall very naturally into, you know, this mysterious past for both sides on the creation evolution side of things. And both of us like to lay claim to the dinosaurs because, after all, God didn't make them. They were day six creations. But from the two sides, it's not surprising that dinosaurs really end up with a lot of the prime time space. They're really kind of the mystical beasts, you know, that we think about from fairy tales, but instead they were real, which makes them even more interesting than tales of dragons and unicorns and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, so that kind of led you then to pursue the paleontology degree and then eventually a geosciences. Is that just kind of led you down that path?
Yeah, so my educational history was an undergraduate degree in earth science at Penn State University, where I studied primarily geology and paleontology, worked with one of the paleontologists there, then went on to a master's degree at the South Dakota School of Mines and Technology and did a master's degree in paleontology there. And then went to the University of Rhode Island, where I worked on my PhD. And the topic was paleontology. The degree names themselves sometimes change from one university or one department to the next. So technically, my PhD is in environmental sciences, because that's what the geology department was within. And inside that, I was working on paleontology. So the whole way through, I like to tell people when they ask what I do, I say I'm a fossils and rocks guy.
Okay, well, thanks for that. You know, you've also recently released a textbook, and I noticed on the cover that Dr. Danny Faulkner is one of the contributors to this book. He's a friend of Real Science Radio. Would you like to share with us a little bit about this textbook?
Well, thank you very much for that. I appreciate the chance to talk about it. It's the first of its kind in that it is a young Earth creation-based textbook for the high school to really college level. At least I'm using it for my classes at Liberty University. And my other co-authors, two from Cedarville, are Dr. John Whitmore and Dr. Stephen Golmer. They are a geologist and an atmospheric scientist, respectively. And you know Dr. Danny Faulkner in astronomy. And so the four of us teamed up about 2 years ago to start putting together a textbook that we could use at a variety of different Christian schools, Liberty and Cedarville being the first ones, but also thinking of Master's College, Truett McConnell, and a wide variety of others. And some of them have started to adopt the textbook. It was really amazing because I've been teaching earth science for 10 years now at the college level, and I've always used a standard secular textbook because that's what's available, but also some of them are really very good. And I know my colleagues at Cedarville and other places were using the same textbooks that I was. They were just, you know, the best on the market. But sooner or later, we realized that there were enough students and enough of an opportunity to put together a textbook that would be able to cover the topics of geology, oceanography, meteorology, and astronomy, and do so from a decidedly creationist perspective. So I was the lead author on the textbook and assembled a team of people who all spent a lot of their time teaching, not just at the college level, but teaching mostly non-science majors, because we wanted this book to be understood by normal humans and not just scientific eggheads. So each one of us has been teaching at least 10 and in some cases over 20 years to non-science major undergraduates. And that really, I think, helps the book with its level of clarity and ease of understanding. We all know what it's like to try and translate heavy science into things that normal people can understand.
Sure. Now, is this a book that's targeted for a certain high school, obviously homeschoolers and Christian high schools? Is that kind of the target audience?
Our first target audience was the college classroom.
Okay.
But as we've understood it as well, first-year undergraduate class, especially for non-science majors, is pretty equivalent to the type of material that you're going to cover in a high school-level class. It's just you're going to cover it a lot quicker. You know, you're going to do it in a semester's worth of time of 4 months or so, rather than a high school year of, you know, 9 or 10 months. So in terms of the content level, it's certainly something that can be applied to a high schooler who's taking earth science. So for the homeschoolers and students at Christian schools, this would be a really great book to use. Not to toot my own horn too much, but we're really very confident that this is something that is clear, that's understandable, but is also richly and lavishly illustrated. We actually worked with a secular publisher on this one, that they saw the market that was available and really courted us to bring a book for them.
That's interesting. You know, I just talked to my son today about electives, and he's a freshman in college. And, you know, this would be maybe a great elective class too. So maybe something like Colorado Christian University or something could teach a course using this textbook. Hey, transfer the elective to wherever you go, or if you still go to that school, that sounds great. I can't wait
absolutely.
To see this.
Yeah, absolutely. The nice thing about those kind of elective classes is that if they're outside of the major that your college student is looking to use, they usually transfer very easily from one college to the other. And so if you're an art or a history or a business major and you take a science class at some place like Colorado Christian, that's going to transfer because the business department is mostly concerned about the business classes that you're taking and not the stuff outside of that.
So will you have that book tonight at the Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship meeting?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll be bringing a few copies along with some of the other materials from my new company, Cornerstone Educational Supply.
Oh, cool. Cornerstone Educational Supply. So I actually looked that up before the interview. So the website is cornerstone-edsupply.com. I checked this website out before the interview, and man, you got some really cool material there. I can't wait to hear more about it.
Well, thanks. It's been a busy year. So in addition to getting the textbook out, I finally decided to pull the trigger and start up a company that would produce educational rock, mineral, and fossil materials for homeschoolers and for Christian schools and, you know, others who are interested in this type of material. I kind of had this idea kicking around for a little while because I work from boxed rock and mineral kits with my students in laboratories at Liberty University. And we use the same boxes and lab materials that every other schools around the country use from, you know, the typical non-Christian companies, just, you know, science service companies. And I realized that, you know, after teaching college for 10 years now, you know, I kind of know my rocks and I kind of know my fossils, and what I had to do was figure out a way to just package this in a way that Christians could buy something that they could really feel comfortable with, that they could encourage their kids and their grandkids with materials that were going to be affirming their faith, rather than one where they'd buy the kit and then they'd have to kind of parse out, well, what's the truth, what's not quite right here, how do I get my kid excited about this, but you know, might be concerned about issues of evolution or ancient age.
Yeah, this looked like really good quality stuff, too.
Yeah, we really wanted to go for materials that were going to be really top-notch in quality and also augment those with good descriptive materials, nice color pictures. We include a young Earth stratigraphic column so people can start to understand what these rocks are in terms of periods of time during Noah's flood, and a lot of extra descriptive stuff. And we also put together some lesson plans and other materials so that this doesn't just become a box of rocks that you take out every once in a while and look and say, you know, oh, that's a pretty mineral, that's a pretty fossil. But we want people to do things with these. We want these to be educational tools to enrich them and help them see the beauty of God's creation, for a lot of the rock and mineral stuff, the usefulness of God's creation. God created a lot of things that He intended us to be able to use to build and use our imaginations and make life a little bit better for us over time.
Yeah, there's that psalm that says God made things that were made to be remembered. I've got that quote on my saltwater tank. Do you use this stuff like in your classes at Liberty? Or I also see that you're the assistant director at Liberty for the Center for Creation Studies. So I'm curious what that is, and it kind of helps out with that course.
Okay, well, great question. The materials that we have at Liberty that I use, say, in my earth science or my geology classes, I actually haven't used any of the stuff from my company yet, because the truth is that, you know, rocks don't tend to go bad over time, and you don't have to reorder a lot of them for your laboratories. Sure. And so I'm content with our school to just keep using the stuff that we have. And we also have a Young Earth Creation lab book that we can now use for the earth science and geology classes. So we can cover the topics that we need to with the materials we already have on hand. But for the Christian schools or for the homeschooling co-ops that are looking to learn about rocks and minerals, this is a big boon to them. And we've had a lot of success with a couple of the large national homeschooling groups really looking at our products and saying, these are what we want. For the Center for Creation Studies, it's got a really neat history that goes long before I was around. The Center for Creation Studies was established in 1986 at Liberty University by the now late Dr. Jerry Falwell. And he wanted to have a permanent academic unit within the campus that dealt with creation evolution issues. And he actually had them create a course that is required of all Liberty students, regardless of their major. So whether you're in business accounting or Spanish language or, you know, anything else, every single student that passes through the residential campus of Liberty takes Creation Studies 290, our basic history of life and creation course.
That's still even today, that's a required course today?
It is.
That's awesome.
It's still a required course. And in fact, I teach one of the three sections of the classes. I've got about 190 students in that class. We have, you know, it's a big lecture class for it. We meet twice a week and really enjoy, especially this semester, I'm having a great time with my students. I've got really sharp ones. We've got a really good dynamic in the class going. And it's great to be able to walk the students through first a little bit of theology and some philosophy of science. And then after that, the bulk of the course is kind of a tour of the sciences as they relate to the creation-evolution controversy.
Okay. Well, you know, I'm going to do a plug for your university because I was there last year with my son. So we were touring different campuses. And man, beautiful campus. We were thoroughly impressed. We went through the computer science building and you walk by classrooms and there's verses on the wall. I mean, you're not going to see that, obviously, at a secular university. And, you know, for my son, ultimately, it was just a little bit too far to go. I mean, because it was his top choice for a while, especially after visiting. But what an impressive place. I mean, you got that once a week chapel service and that great facility. I think, I don't know, maybe you also have your basketball games there or something. It's a really nice auditorium. It's huge. And the place was almost packed.
That's the Vine Center, and actually have our convocation service, which is kind of like a chapel, a little bit more diverse than a chapel might be, but they go to that three times a week, and the entirety of the university all attends or watches on Wednesdays. So if you're a residential student, you do that three times, and then if you're faculty, staff, et cetera, basically the university shuts down from about 10:30 to 11:45 every Wednesday so we can all be kind of one together. For worship, for announcements, and also to hear from pastors, from business leaders, from sports people. I mean, it's really amazing the wide variety of Christians and occasionally non-Christians that we have come and speak to the student body at Liberty.
Yeah, your list of speakers there, I mean, it's a long list of incredibly impressive. Tim Tebow, I know, was there. And recently I read about Even Bernie Sanders was there, so that had to be interesting. Yeah,
he was here this semester just a couple of weeks ago, and just on Wednesday we had Dr. Ben Carson speaking.
Yeah, Dr. Carson.
And we also had Ted Cruz announce his candidacy at our campus last semester. So I've told my students that regardless of what you think in terms of political persuasions, it's kind of astonishing that we are at a university where this many people of this caliber come in order to dialogue with us, that they consider our school, you know, a place that is worthy to come and announce their candidacy or, you know, present their ideas. And especially for someone like Bernie Sanders, I mean, he knows he's coming to a school that is not going to look eye to eye with him on most any issue. And so, you know, he got a lot of respect from our students for coming and presenting, even if most of our students were unpersuaded by his perspectives.
Yeah, hopefully so. Yeah. No, that's great.
Yeah, my gauge of the students was he didn't really win over too many converts on his trip.
Yeah,
but I do give him props for coming.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I know my daughter. She's 3 years away from college, and that's definitely really at the top of the list right now. It's a great, 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 great school. I can't say enough about it. I was thoroughly impressed. I really was. Not just saying that because you don't know what to expect when you go out there. It's a beautiful campus, and just impressed with the way that we were treated. And again, seeing Bible verses written on the walls, you know, it's a conservative, biblically based, very strong university. And they got a great reputation too with the degrees you guys are putting out. My son, again, was computer science. I know you got engineering. You got everything. It's a great school. I have no qualms doing a big advertisement for your school during this show. So,
well, I really appreciate it. And I can also plug that after you had taken your trip this semester, we opened up our brand new science building. Beautiful state-of-the-art facility. It is really one of the nicest new science buildings really in the country. You know, the amazing thing about it is you've got four floors full of people in chemistry, in biology, and in health sciences. And everybody in every office is a prayerful, considerate Christian, and our departments are full of creationists. So, you know, you could have me speaking, you know, tonight with you, but on the same time, you could pretty much fill the rest of your year with the science faculty at Liberty University.
Wow, that's, you know, and I know that can confirm this. I think you're the number one online university right now, aren't you?
We're the largest not-for-profit private school out there as far as online. We have about 100,000 online students.
Wow.
In addition to the 13,000 residential students we have. So yeah, it's a big school. And that was one of the things that really attracted me to the school when I was looking for places where I might be able to work. I went to Penn State for my undergraduate, and I really liked the big, big school experience. And so when I came to Liberty in 2005, Jerry Falwell Sr. had this vision of having this enormous school of 25,000 undergraduates and another 25,000 online. And well, now we've got 100,000 online and 13,000 residential. So there's just an amazing kind of energy that happens when you get that many people and that many resources together.
Yeah. And, you know, when we went there, they were very, very receptive to working with you with, you know, on finances, all those kind of things. A friend of my son, Mike Durrell, he's going there now. And, you know, I know that they kind of struggle a little bit financially, and Liberty really worked with them and somehow pulled it off. And, you know, Mike's going to that school and already hearing reports back that he absolutely loves it. So
that's great to hear.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, speaking of Bernie Sanders, you know, so I watched that debate here a couple nights ago. And, you know, Rand Paul said that in defense of his support of global warming or climate change, he referred to the Earth as 4.6 billion years old. So I wanted to ask you, as a scientist with a PhD in geosciences, how would you respond to Rand Paul? Not that I'm a moderator here or anything.
No, and not that I'm going to be sharing a stage with him at any point in the future. He's he's way up there on the presidential contestants there. If I had the chance to sit down and chat with Rand Paul on that topic, I would say I certainly understand why, you know, you believe that the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. I went to, you know, three different schools and was taught by dozens of professors that when they made arguments about the age of the Earth made a lot of sense. So the first thing I would come at with this is, you know, a recognition of, I see why you think this is the case. On the flip side, I'd say, however, there's a lot of assumptions that go into making an estimate about how old something happens to be. And in the sciences like geology, where you're attempting to peer back through time in some way, the number of uncertainties in the data gets a lot bigger than if you're simply trying to drop a ball down the side of a building in a physics experiment and see how fast gravity is pulling it down. And those numbers of uncertainties result in some troubling issues for things like radioactive dating. Briefly, the ones that I talk to my students about, when it comes to the age of 4.6 billion years, that's being gotten after by various types of uranium dating and a few of the other radioactive isotopes. And I'd point them to the studies done by the RATE team, which was a group of creation scientists in geology and physics that looked at things like the amount of helium that is a byproduct of uranium decay that should be leaking out of crystals actually pretty quickly. As the uranium decays into lead, it produces 8 helium atoms along the way, and those helium atoms don't react with anything. They're what we call noble gases, and so they just kind of wiggle their way out of the crystal structure, like kids playing in a jungle gym type of thing. Well, the warmer that crystal is, the faster the helium gets out, and the smaller the crystal, the easier that it gets out because it finds the edges. And that means that we can get an idea of how fast a crystal should lose its helium based on how hot it is and how big it is. And what the RATE team discovered was that by sampling some of the crystals that have this stuff in it, the helium hadn't gone anywhere. It stayed in the crystal. And if you were an old Earth proponent, that you'd basically have to hold that crystal near absolute zero for millions and billions of years. Well, the Earth doesn't have that temperature anywhere. In fact, the deeper you go down in the Earth, the warmer it gets, not the cooler. So you're left with this conundrum that it looks like a whole bunch of radioactive decay happened. It certainly looks like it did, but it doesn't look like the products went where they should have gone. The products look like they only were leaking for about the last 6,000 years, plus or minus. And that's a leak rate that's very easy to calculate. It's based on very simple physics. And so that looks like a more robust argument for the age of the crystal than the 4.6 billion years.
Yeah, you know, I'd love the argument you just brought up, and man, you did it so eloquent. I wish I could state it like that. I remember talking to Russ Humphreys at a creation conference. They made their predictions in one of the ICC journals before they got the, you know, they made a prediction like science is supposed to do, and they submitted it to an independent lab that wasn't aware that this was a creation experiment. I remember talking to him at this meeting, and he's like, just stay tuned. The results are coming in and they're really cool. They're falling right along the lines of our predictions. And then the results came out and then they published it, I think, in a subsequent ICC paper.
Yeah, they had their own volume, the RATE 1 and the RATE 2 volume.
That's right. Yeah. So what a
neat... they did go to ICC and present that research as well.
Yep. So we're actually getting low on time. You mentioned dinosaurs earlier. Man, I wanted to talk to you about the soft tissue thing and how much you've used that in your arguments. I think that's been a great evangelistic tool for Christians. I can't say how many times I've been able to use that when I talk to secular friends. They're shocked that they're actually finding soft tissue in dinosaur bones. And, you know, now they've even found DNA. Rational Wiki still has on their website that you shouldn't find DNA in dinosaur bones if young Earth creation is true. They, you know, that's been there for like, I think, 7 years now. When are they going to take that down? Because now they've found DNA in dinosaur bones. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it continues to be a really powerful argument for a young Earth. And I wrote a little bit about this for an Answers Magazine article several years back. And one of the things that I said is that even myself as a young Earth creationist, I hadn't anticipated something like this. And perhaps that's just because of, you know, what I was taught from my secular peers and professors about how fossilization happens. That even I didn't have the glasses to see something like this. You know, paleontologist Mary Schweitzer, along with Jack Horner and other team of folks, first discovered the soft tissues really by accident in Schweitzer's lab. One of her lab techs was supposed to be dissolving some of the bone material away, and he actually left the sample in the solution overnight and came back, and you know, most of it had been dissolved away, and he was really kind of sorry, but then he looked at it and he realized, wait a minute, there's something weird here. He showed it to Schweitzer, and her response was, do it again. not, you know, you're in trouble. Do it again. And if it happens again, then we'll call Jack Horner. And, so her discussion of how this all went about was really weird. They had this big leg bone of a T-Rex. They had to break it in order to get it out. It smelled bad. They brought it back to the lab. All this happens. And they end up isolating original tissues of blood vessels and possibly blood cells and a few other things. The paleontological community, and I can say this because I've been at the meetings where, you know, some of this was discussed and talked about, was really polarized there. I mean, it was one of those, we'd love for it to be true, but I don't really think that it can be, or there's no way that's true, or other people saying, this is pretty amazing. I mean, it was really quite a spectrum with some really strong people on either side and a lot of people in the middle just kind of waiting to see what would happen.
It seems like to me it's a paleontological find of the century. Or am I exaggerating?
It really was. You know, if paleontology had a Nobel Prize, it probably would have gone to Schweitzer for that.
Wow.
Because not only did she find it and publish that in 2005, there were challenges to that, saying that, you know, these were materials that were actually made by bacteria. They were just kind of secretions that were inside where the blood vessels used to be. So they're not really the original dinosaur blood vessels. They're what these bacteria made inside. Well, she came back with a paper to respond to those criticisms in 2009, and I really very infrequently get to read a piece of science writing that was so thoroughly done and so strongly argued and had so many precautions in terms of the laboratories. Actually, had three independent labs all working on this together to make sure that they, you know, weren't contaminating their samples and all that sort of stuff. And then it just keeps rolling out. There's one of a duck-billed dinosaur. Mark Armitage, who I think you've had on your program before as well, he discovered soft tissues in the horn core of a triceratops. There's been soft tissues discovered in the critters that I studied for my PhD work, mosasaurs, the big swimming marine lizards.
Yeah.
And actually, I was just at a meeting of the Geological Society of America last week, and there was a poster being presented there of people who also found soft tissues in another duck-billed dinosaur in South Dakota, and found it actually in some pretty marginal bone, you know, not the sort of stuff like Schweitzer's where you had really hard, hard bone around the outside. This was stuff that had a lot of openings and holes and the sort of thing that you wouldn't expect excellent preservation to find itself in.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they found the same branching blood vessel structures and the fossilized bone-forming cells that Schweitzer saw in some of these other things. So the dam is broken open now. And people are really looking around for this sort of stuff. And it seems to be in a lot more places than anybody thought possible.
Exactly. And I know even Harvard and, you know, a lot of the major universities are on board now. So people are surprised to hear that. But you can't blame
it on
biofilm.
The shock of it all is that these types of original materials that, you know, were from the dinosaurs, that were from the mosasaurs, that were from ancient birds and the like, have been preserved. And the chemistry doesn't seem to permit them to exist for hundreds of thousands, let alone tens of millions of years.
Yep.
There's a really interesting study done on moa fossils. Moa were these big flightless birds in New Zealand that were hunted to extinction. But looking at the bones that were found of moas in several different caves, a group of researchers came up with a plot of how fast the DNA degraded in these environments. And they said, listen, by the time you get to 2 million years, best case scenario, you only have, you know, one or two or three bits of DNA that might be connected together. And yet Schweitzer comes out with one of her most recent papers and has DNA fragments from the T-Rex, which is supposed to be 68 million years old. The chemistry just doesn't allow this sort of thing
to
happen.
Exactly. There's no way those dinos are millions of years old. There's just no way. It's a, you know, it's a great tool now for creationists. Well,
yeah.
Dr. Ross, we're actually out of time.
Absolutely. Dinosaur bones should not be gooey on the inside.
Yeah. That's right.
If they're this ancient.
Yeah. Anybody can Google this stuff online and you'll see the pictures. It's really impressive. So I know you're going to be at Calvary Apostolic Church tonight at 7 p.m. and you're going to present on the topic of meteorites and mosasaurs. So people can go to youngearth.org to get more details on how to get there. It's real easy to find. Again, it's just a couple blocks east of I-25 on Yale. Really look forward to seeing you there, Dr. Ross. Also, don't forget to help keep us on the air by going to rsr.org. There's lots of great stuff in the store. You can also go to realscienceradio.com. Finally, don't forget to check out the KJV only debate at theologyonline.com, where Bob and Will Duffy are they're debating the noted KJV only proponent, Will Kenny. Bob will be back in studio next Friday for another edition of Real Science Friday. And again, thank you, Dr. Ross. What a great honor it was to have you on the show. And
thank you very much, Fred. And I look forward to seeing everybody at the meeting tonight.
Yeah, that'll be great. We'll see you then. Adios, everybody. We'll see you next week.